the good fortune of spending some time with the ambassador in the last 24 hours, and I would just tell you that you are in for a big treat. My name is Jean Phillips, and it is really a personal privilege and pleasure to introduce to you one of the most effective diplomats that I've ever had the pleasure of knowing. His Excellency, Ambassador Gerard Araud, is known in Washington and around the world as a very strong, transparent, effective voice for America's longest, oldest ally, France. His career has carried him to the Middle East as the French ambassador to Israel. It then carried him to New York as the French ambassador to the United Nations, and now he is posted, of course, in Washington, D.C. I think at this point in our country's history, it's safe to say that he was put there for a reason, because most of our friends across the world are wondering what in the heck is going on this year with us. The ambassador has many friends across the globe, but while some are perhaps as devoted as his fans here in Texas, none surpass those of us who've watched his successful and effective voice in the complicated international dialogue of today. And he has yielded great results, very generously, not just for France, but for the Western democracies who are our friends. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our friend, his first visit to Dallas, the French ambassador to the United States of America.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Phillips, for this very nice introduction, and thank you for everybody to be here. You know, I'm a bit embarrassed because I'm supposed to make, I guess, an opening joke, and usually my opening jokes are not very acceptable for college students. So really, but nevertheless, you know, really, and I'm French, so I can do a lot of things that an American can't, you know, really. And I think it's, speaking of elections, you know, really, I think it's in a Woody Allen movie. You know, the French love Woody Allen. And it's the sister of Woody Allen saying to Woody Allen, you know, you are only sarcasm, nihilism, and orgasm. And Woody Allen answers, you know, with this program, I would be elected in France. So in these three elements, I think I'm a bit limited to sarcasm. And I would want to be sarcastic about your political life, but unfortunately, to be frank, all over Europe, it's not much better than your political life. You know, really, the crisis that you are going through, you know, that we have, really, we are through it. I hope it will be end on 8th of November. Actually, it's the same political crisis that all the Western democracies are facing. Brexit, you know, in the UK, it's exactly the same populist backlash, and all over the Western Europe, continental Europe, the far right or the far left, by the way, you know, really, it's the same phenomenon. And so I do hope that whoever is elected president of the United States, that she will face, you know, with us, this crisis. We have to work together. What the electors are telling us, you know, has to be taken seriously. We are democracies. Some of our citizens are expressing their anger, their resentment. They are sending a message. I think it will be totally critical that the next president of the United States, but also the next president of France, who will be elected in May 2017, the next chancellor of Germany, who will be elected in October 2017, that all together we work to respond to this social and economic crisis. Let's come to, I think, to my remarks. I will make remarks on two topics, and I will try to be short. Well, when an ambassador says I will be short, it's 25 minutes of platitudes. But I will be really short, So that you can ask really questions on any topic, and you are, of course, you are allowed to contradict me. You know, really, I am a Democrat. I want to talk about what happened in Paris in December 2015, which is the conference on climate change. Because I think it was a phenomenal event, because it was the first time that all the countries, but not only all the countries, there was also the CEO of the major corporations throughout the world, and especially a lot of American CEO, and there was also the cities, you know, really, which has been gathered by Michael Bloomberg, who did a phenomenal job, you know, really, as special representative of the UN Secretary General and the mayor of Paris, but also the civil society. Everybody said, and it was the first time, we are serious about a low-carbon economy, we are serious about climate change, and we have to fight it together. And it was very important because fighting climate change in the coming decades won't be really reached through a top-down approach. It's really changing the way we are considering not only the economic growth, but in a sense our daily life. So it means that we need a commitment of every citizen. You can be skeptical. You can say, oh, these countries, they have taken commitments. They are not going to abide by their commitments. But I think you shouldn't underestimate that in any country, look at China, for instance, you have an extremely strong pressure from the public opinion. And this mobilization is essential so that we can move forward. The figures, in a sense, the figures that we have agreed in Paris are not that important because we don't know what will be the technology of tomorrow. And, you know, I've spent the 2015 year traveling throughout this country, and I have really visited a lot of laboratories. And as you can guess, this country is so creative that you can say the technology is there, or it's very close to be there. I think you can't underestimate what is going to happen in scientific terms. So we need the mobilization of all the young guys here to put the pressure of your parents and grandparents who from time to time are a bit slow to convince them that not only, you know, we have to fight climate change, but actually it will be good for the economy, that the technology is there, and there will be a lot of things that we can do which will be good for the economy and also good to fighting climate change. And, you know, especially in this part of the country, with all the winds in the Midwest and with the sun, that actually you can produce a lot of electricity, you know, sustainable electricity. And everywhere I went in the U.S., all the mayors I have met, all the CEOs I have met, you know, I'm really working, for instance, with Walmart. You know, Walmart is not, for hipsters in Brooklyn. You know, really, it's a real pop and mop shop. Walmart is committed to fighting climate change. Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, and I could give you a long, long list of American corporations which are committed to fighting the climate change. We have to keep the momentum, and this momentum has to be kept by the civil society, by the cities, by the corporations, and also by the states. And what I can say is, you know, we had this agreement in December in Paris. Well, you could say, okay, they have signed, but at the first signal, you know, they could change their policy. Actually, no. Since then, we have had a lot of meetings, and no country has really told us, oh, you know, I made a mistake, I didn't want, and actually I'm changing. No, everybody is on board, and you may have seen that actually China and the United States have ratified the agreement together. And we have no, you know, we are working very hard with India also, you know, really, because India has, of course, needs a lot of energy, and they want to be really on the front line of producing solar energy. Of course, we will need fossils. We will need fossil energy in the coming decades, but we can and we should actually act together for fighting climate change. Actually, I went to try to convey this message in Houston, you know, really to a conference. I think it was the conference on oil producers, you know, really. And I suddenly I was full of consideration for Governor Romney. Why? You said, what is the relationship? Actually, Governor Romney, actually, as you know, was a Mormon missionary who went to France to try to convert the French to a non-alcoholic religion. But actually, to add to the merit of Governor Romney, he went to Bordeaux. So suddenly, you know, really, I'm going to Houston to speak about climate change and non-fossil energy. I had the impression suddenly I understood Governor Romney in Bordeaux. You know, really. But all jokes apart, and I really I can assure you that once you cross the Beltway, you are in this incredible country. You meet everywhere people who have understood that it's the next horizon. For the business community, for the society, for really, and I'm really, I trust that, again, without making jokes, whoever will be elected as president, I think it's a momentum that nobody will be able to stop, and especially I trust the youth here, you know, to prevent the people, to prevent your parents and grandparents, you know, from stopping this movement. The second part of my introduction will be about what happens in France with the terrorist attacks that actually we have been victims several times. You know, really, January 2015 with the assassination of the journalist of Charlie Hebdo and the attack of the kosher grocery store. November with the attack, you know, really, in a theater, really, and eventually on Bastille Day in Nice, really, which were the major terrorist attacks, which cost the life of 250 people, but there were other incidents, you know, a Roman Catholic priest was slaughtered in his church, and so on, and so on. So what is happening right now is... in a sense, is that the Syrian civil war is becoming a world crisis, and the Europeans, we are on the front line because of our geography. As for France has a population, I should say, about 8% of the population is a Muslim population, and we have 2,000 French who went to are back from Syria. 2,000 people decided that they wanted to fight in Syria. As you can guess, they will come back, even if 180 have been killed in Syria already, and they will come back, and they will come back radicalized and military trained, and rapidly anti-Semitic. And we have the first Jewish community out of the U.S. And we have not identified all these people. You know, really, they leave, they don't tell the police we are leaving. We have not identified all of them, so it's extremely dangerous. We have changed our legislation, really, to be able to prevent them from leaving first, because a lot of these people are young, and their families see that they are radicalized. So we have created, you know, a hotline, and so that the families can get in touch with our social services, so we can either try to handle the issue, de-radicalize them, or if we see that they may be dangerous, we can deprive them from their passport so they can't go to Syria. Or when they come back, we are able to arrest them and convict them, you know, really to indict them. Nevertheless, it's obvious that we are facing an enduring threat. We are not the only ones to do it, since, you know, there were terrorist attacks also in Belgium, in Denmark. It's very simple. It's very why, you know, you go to a gate of Paris, and for 80 euros, you can have a bus, and the bus is driving you to Istanbul. And from Istanbul, you disappear, and you go to Syria. There are networks, you know, really. So the geography is such that it's very difficult for us to prevent this this phenomenon. So the first thing that we have to do, of course, fighting the terrorism, is to improve our means, our willy, which means legal and material means of our police forces. You know what happened after the 9/11. You know, really, our lives are, our societies are a sort of an easy balance between freedom and law enforcement. And when you have this sort of crisis, the balance is shifting to law enforcement. And we have to do it, and we did it, you know, while trying, of course, while maintaining the democratic life and democratic rights of our societies. But again, as I have said, considering the threat, it's really extremely difficult to be sure that nothing will happen. And considering this terrorist threat, considering also what I said about the populist backlash, you can guess that it's leading, you know, really to acts of to tensions with our Muslim population. You know, really, the same thing that is happening in this country, but in our country, it's we have 8%, while in this country it's 1%. So it's leading to Islamophobia. It's leading to racial tensions, and the question leading also to the questions of how to accommodate Islam in the French society. And it's a very difficult debate. I'm not sure that we are handling it the best way. You know, we are a democratic society, so there are really different opinions. You know, there was during the summer, maybe you saw it, a silly debate about attire on the are you allowed to wear really veil on the beach? You know, really, it was a very silly debate, but actually it was the symbol of the questions that we are facing in a very regular manner. You know, people are coming to us and saying, oh, I don't want my daughter to go to the gym club, to go to the gym. We want to have women-only days in the swimming pool. We don't want to have a male doctor, you know, looking at my wife. So we have a lot of these questions. And the problem in a Western democracy where men and women are equal, the problem that we all have is where to put the line, what to allow and what not to allow. You know, really, some people, you know, really, I went to explain this politics to American universities, you know, Harvard, Brown, and so I had in front of me a lot of liberals. You know, really, and they were saying, but why do you put a line? You know, why do you put a line? But we are obliged to put a line. Why? I told them, I said, why do you forbid polygamy? You know, really, because they were saying, if this woman accepted, they should be able to do it. I said, and if they accept polygamy, are you going to accept polygamy? No, we have to put a line somewhere. What? You know, when in the hospitals. You know, hospital is a very tricky manner. You know, really, you have really men saying, no way, I don't want a male doctor. And if there is only a male doctor around, you know, what to do? And so on. So it's a real debate. You know, what we call, in French, we say, you know, considering that we are secular religion, that we have to accept reasonable accommodation of religion. You know, for instance, you know, really, when the Catholic Church was saying that on Friday you have to eat fish, you know, now it's not anymore the case, but it was the case. So, you know, the schoolboys had fish on Friday in schools. You know, it was reasonable accommodation. No principle was broken, and we were taking care, you know, really. So obviously not to serve pork in school is also reasonable accommodation, not only for Muslims, but actually also for Jews, you know, really. So, you know, you have this reasonable accommodation. The question is where to stop. And there is no clear answer, because I'm sure that between you there will be different answers if we were making a poll. And as you can guess, and here I'm going to to give an American example, you know that also in local situation, local authorities have very different positions. I don't want to remind, you know, really the Americans about abortion according to the states. So you have very different positions of the different American states. We have also in France very different positions according to the local authorities. You know, really, some are very to the right, so they are really very, very intransigent, in a sense, against what the Muslims are asking. Other ones are to the left, and they are really more open, and so on, and so on. So there is a healthy debate, but a political debate with the terrorist threat, a terrorist and a political debate with this populist resentment, it's not easy. You know, really, I'm sure that we'll go through it, but you have to understand that from time to time, the answers which are given are not the right ones. We are committing mistakes, and we are going to commit mistakes. But in a sense, we have the first Jewish community in the out of the U.S. And it's really the way this community is threatened by Islamic terrorism is a major concern for us. You know, really, if you go to Paris, you'll see that the synagogues, the Jewish schools, are protected by the army because these terrorists are rabidly anti-Semitic. So it's really which has led a lot of our citizens actually to leave the country because they are afraid. So that's really for us a major challenge. And we have also all our Muslim citizens, you know, they are French. 99% of them are French, very often born in France, you know, really. And most of them actually are not terrorists, are not really, they are hostage of this tiny minority. So that's one of the challenge that we are facing today. So life is not that easy. You know, there is the economic crisis that all European countries are still really muddling through out of it, you know, really, the migration. But I do believe that Europe, and especially France, but all European countries are your best allies, are the most solid allies, and we are your first market. We are still your first market. So I think that we have a lot of interest, a lot of values together, and we have to work together. Our intelligence services are working very well. Our soldiers are fighting together. The French, as you may know, have deployed thousands of soldiers in Africa fighting terrorism, and we are doing it with the support of the Americans in terms of tactical air support, air intelligence. We have been the first one to join the Americans in striking ISIS in Syria, and we have right now 4,000 soldiers in Iraq, as much as the Americans, by the way, and we have an aircraft carrier deployed there. So our soldiers are fighting together, and I met Senator McCain recently, and he told me that he went there, and he was really very impressed by what the French were doing in Africa. So we are together, and we know by experience that we need to be together. Europeans and Americans, we need to be together, especially in these challenging times where we are facing major problems, major domestic and major external problems. Thank you very much.
We have a tradition at the World Affairs Council to often give a student the first question. Jordan Galvin, where are you? Jordan? Would you please stand? Great. I'll read your question. And Jordan is a student at Berkner High School. In light of recent news with the closing of the jungle in Calais, how is France planning to support the current refugees and future influx of refugees while maintaining basic human rights?
Thank you very much. You have to know that there is a very specific situation where refugees want to go to England, and we have an agreement with the British where the border you know, the border can be controlled at their on their side of the channel, on our side of the channel, and there was an agreement for to do it on our side of the channel. So the refugees arrive, they want to go to England, and the British say, no, we don't want you. So basically, they have created, a little by little, it has created a camp of refugees. You know, thousands of people are there. It's core and living in this small situation. And our situation was, we had a choice. Either we were creating a real camp of refugees there, so they have decent conditions, but it would have become a city. You know, you have thousands of refugees and more arriving. And it was, you know, we were organizing a camp of refugees for the British. It was really very difficult. So we decided that the best way was to dismantle, which was not a camp. It's called the jungle because it was so dismal. And that all the refugees, the political refugees, will be spread over to France. So it means that we have been really by a group of 10 or 15, they are sent everywhere in France, so we can't really take care of them according to the international norms and international conventions. So it's what we are doing. And it's very tough. It's very tough because everywhere, you know, again, try to imagine if you decided to send, you know, really thousands of refugees all over the place. In each city, as you can guess, the far right is demonstrating. You know, he's waiting for the refugees, saying we don't want them. You know, really, it's feeding this sort of populist backlash, but we are doing it because we don't have any other choice. So again, they will be treated according to the international norms. We are going to respect their human rights. But behind that, behind this very particular case, we have the major problem of migrants, and because of the geography of Europe. You know, what happened last year, and frankly, Germany was extremely generous, 1 million, you know, 1 million of migrants entered Germany in a few months. It was exactly like if 4 million of migrants would have crossed the Rio Grande. What happened? What would have happened in the US if it had been the case? First, technically, what to do with these people? What to do with people? Where to house them? Where to shelter them? And after that, also in political sense. You know, Germany so far was the only European country which had been immune to the far right, you know, for historical reasons, I guess. And after the courageous and very generous decision of Chancellor Merkel to greet this 1 million of immigrants, the far right has soared throughout all the local elections in Germany. You know, really. So that's the balance that we have to understand. You know, the for the political leaders to take a decision, it's never really the good decision or the bad decision. You know, really, it has always to balance what will be good and bad. What can I do? And it's obvious that if you right now, if you say, you know, and maybe at your age, you say, oh, you have to be generous. The problem is very clearly that if you are as generous as the German chancellor, it may mean that you are going to lose the next election. And Germany, actually, the chancellor will go for a general election in October 2017. So it's a tough challenge. We have to understand that it's not clear cut. It's not generosity versus selfishness. It's simply to do what is doable, and what is doable is what a society can accept. You know, really. And the level of acceptance of a society is depending on its traditions, but also its economic health. You know, really, a prosperous country is more generous than a country which is going through economic dire straits and so on and so on. So it's what is right now what Europeans are obliged to do. You know, frankly, thousands of migrants are arriving on our shores on a daily basis. And also looking at the geography, you have Africa. The population of Africa will double in the next 30 or 40 years. And so there will be an attraction towards Europe. And simply, we can't accommodate all these migrants. So it's a real challenge. And for the moment, no country has found the real answer.
We have roving microphones. Your questions, please. I have a question back there. And while we're waiting for the microphone, I wonder if you might, given your experience working on the Iran negotiations, give your perspective about how the Iran deal is working. And why does Iran still continue to be such a driver of terrorism?
So maybe the question and I will answer.
Great. Thank you. So correct me if I'm wrong, but and I understand the current refugee crisis, but looking back over the decades, I think there's a perception of many that the U.S. and Canada, for instance, have done a better job in assimilating their immigrant populations. And given the repercussions over a period of time of failing to assimilate the immigrant population, I wonder, in hindsight, if there's anything you think that Western Europe could have done better.
No, I think the problem first, really, I'm obliged as an ambassador not to be critical of the host country, so I won't be. But I think you have to, I am a teacher in the closet, really, basically. So when I try to explain foreign policy, I always say that a solution which is working in one country may not work in another country. And so it means that as a Frenchman, for instance, let's look at something non-controversial, your guns laws. For any Europeans, it's totally crazy. But if I were going to say, as an European, oh, you should go the European way, it would be totally irrelevant. But you won't, because of your history and so on. So it means that every country is not rational. Every country is a sort of irrational social and cultural fabric. So there are things which work there which won't work in my country. So. What is first, we are not France and Europe, we are not countries of immigrants. It's very important that in this country, everybody is an immigrant or as a grandparent or grand-grandparent an immigrant, really. So in a sense, you are a society of immigration, of immigrants. In France, I can go to a small village and I have my ancestors buried there till the 16th or the 17th century. I don't have, in all my family a foreigner as far as I can go and so on and so on. So we are now a country of immigration and it's very difficult to adjust the fact that, in a sense, we have very strong roots. So there is a sort of very strong commitment to the French, from part of the French population, to their roots, to the village, to the history and the long history. And we have immigrants coming which don't have these roots, which don't have this reference, and we have to adjust. And again, it's not easy. But I really, at the same time, I think that the real problem, is jobs. And the fact is that, as you know, most of the people, the first victims of unemployment are usually the immigrants. And if we have integrated very well, actually the Italians, very well the Spaniards, very well the Portuguese, and also the Algerians coming in the 50s, it's not because, the first ones were Christians, it's because there were jobs. So the integration is through jobs. And the fact is for a long time, we have had a high rate of unemployment. And I think that's which explains the malaise in the suburbs. For me, it's more an economic crisis, which is expressing through a cultural claim. And I think that we need growth. We need growth. We need to give to these people, a real economic prospect. I'm going to, the American Embassy in Paris is organizing a great, great program, sending, really young schoolboys, and coming from underprivileged neighborhoods to the U.S. And 40 of them came to the French embassy. And really, and there were, I guess, really, there were a lot of people coming from Africa. You had from the Maghreb, most of them. And, you know, they told me, they said, oh, you know, really, Mr. Ambassador, you are our ambassador. I said, yes, of course. You know, could we have a picture? So we have a picture. And when we have the picture, one of them took a French flag, you know, really, and waved the French flag. And I was, of course, I was very moved, you know, really saying, you know, if the far right was seeing that. But I concluded definitely they were very, very French, because a girl came to me and told me, Mr. Ambassador, are you living here? I said, yes, of course. She said, it's horrible, isn't it? I said, why? She said, the food. I said, okay. I said, she's French. She's really French, you know, really. So that's really, but no, again, of course, we could have made things different. But it's I guess, really, again, I go back to the economy. I go back also to the fact that there is this populist backlash, really, and again, the populism, as you have in this country, you know, as is choosing as a target the immigrants, you know, in a sort of totally rational way, the immigrants, you know, the Mexican immigrants, while actually Mexicans are leaving the country, you know, really, and it's also the same. So when you feel also attacked or criticized by part of the population and a significant part of the population, you feel obliged also, in a sense, to retreat into your family or into your community, you know, really. So it may explain tensions now that we didn't have with the previous generations. It's also one of the questions, is that the parents are much less religious and much more integrated in the French society than the children, really, which is also, really, there is also the fact that there is this sort of new Islamic fervor everywhere in the Arab world. You know, when I went to Cairo in the 70s, you know, the women wear the same attire that really the Western societies. You know, really, you had the impression to be in the city of the south of Europe. Now you go to Cairo and 90% of the women are wearing a scarf or a veil. You know, it's also a factor. And this factor is reflected among the French Muslims. The parents are absolutely no religious. They are traditionalists, but they are not religious, while suddenly their children are imposing the religion on the parents, saying, oh, you should respect the Ramadan, or you should, and so on. And so that's also an element which is very particular. Going to Iran, the Iran deal, I was the French negotiator on the Iran deal between 6 and 9, but actually at the time it was very easy to negotiate because there was no negotiation, actually. The Iranians didn't negotiate, and they changed. I think they changed around 2012, 2013. They concluded that they needed a negotiation. Why? Because the sanctions were hurting. The sanctions were decided by the European Union, decided by the Americans, and followed by Japan, Australia, and our good friends Canada, and our good friends, you know, really were hurting. So they entered into the negotiation. After that, we have reached, and very, very, it was very difficult to reach a deal. You can look at some elements of the deal saying, oh, that's not enough. You have to look at it as a global deal. It's not a bad deal. You know, it's a good way to stop the Iranian nuclear program. And so far, the Iranians are abiding by their signature. And, you know, really, which shows that actually the Iranians needed this agreement. They wanted this agreement not because of goodwill. Goodwill doesn't exist in foreign policy. You know, it's simply they were obliged to, and they feel they have a strong interest. Why? Because of the dismal situation of their economy, which was the result of the sanctions, of their inept management of the economy. So really, and the population is growing very, very quickly. So they decided that really the regime, for its own survival, needed to improve the economy. So for the moment, they are abiding by their signature. And we have a lot of controls in place. The question is why are not they don't behave on in the other fields? First, because it was an agreement on the nuclear issue. And we had been, on our side, we had been very, very careful to speak only on the nuclear issue, because we didn't want to be obliged to make concessions on the nuclear issue in exchange of a concession elsewhere. We considered that the nuclear issue in itself was so critical that it should be treated as isolated from the rest. Really, it's the nuclear issue, really. And the rest, in a sense, Iran is really basically is really has the same policy it has had since the revolution. You know, really, in the Middle East and like elsewhere. And I think that more and more we are back to this logic in foreign policy, which is the power politics. Really, what the Russians are doing, what the Chinese are doing, is power politics, balance of power. And I think that we, the West, either we have forgotten what it was, the Europeans, or we have never been very good at it, the Americans, the balance of power. You know, really, so it means that a country is considering its security, its security interest, and is defending it and promoting it. So in the Middle East right now, you know, if you look at it as a student, you see what are the powers in the Middle East. You know, Iraq is not anymore a power, and I'm not making any remark on that. Iraq has been destroyed as a power. It's not anymore a power, a significant power. And Iraq had been, you know, for decades, actually the dam against Iran. It was the dam against Iran. So Iraq is not here anymore. Syria is in the middle of civil war, and Egypt is going through its own crisis. So it means that on the Arab side of the balance of power, you have only the Saudi Arabia now left. And Saudi Arabia, you know, really, Iran is a big country. So it means that Saudi Arabia, our friends, Saudi friends, are nervous. You know, really, they are nervous. They need us. And I really should say, when you see the way the Iranians are really, really moving forward, I think we need to balance, we need to reassure our Saudi friends, the Gulf states, you know, we need to balance Iran. And again, it's not because it's the Islamic Republic of Tehran. It will be the monarchy or democracy. It will be the same. You know, it's power politics. Iran is the main power in the region. Iran wants to impose its will. You know, it's normal. That's foreign policy. But our interest is certainly to balance Iran, and especially on the two battlefields now, Yemen and Syria.
We have time for about two more questions. Yes, sir. Chip, if you'll wait for the mic. And who else has a question so we can see? Great.
There is also there.
Lots of questions.
Oops. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you for your comments and for coming to Dallas to share them with us. My question is sparked by the intriguing hint you gave a need post-election in the U.S., for our leaders to respond to the populism. The same issue is there, of course, in France and many developed countries. Trade is one obvious, you know, route, making the trade agreements more fair and accessible, because we do know from the new research that it costs jobs in ways we didn't anticipate. What other policies did you have in mind to help growth and that underlying cause of so much discontent, terrorism as well as the far right populism?
No, I think you have emphasized one the major issue, in a sense, which could become the victim of the populism. You know, really, we have a very recent example, a very unfortunate recent example in Europe. You know, we have signed a very innovative, actually, trade agreement with Canada. Very innovative, and again, Canada, in a very close, in a sense, is a very comparable society to the Europeans in terms of welfare state, respect of the environment and the social norms. So really, it's a very. But we did it, trying also to answer to some objections. So it's really a very for us. We considered a new type of trade agreement with Canada. And it was just, apparently, it was derailed by the vote of an obscure local assembly in Belgium. And to be frank, and I think our Canadian friends told us, if we, the Europeans, we are not able to sign a trade agreement with Canada, we will sign no trade agreement with nobody. And the problem is that nobody, of course, has read the agreement with Canada. You know, really, Canada is a victim by proxy, is receiving, you know, a lost bullet. There is such an outcry in Europe against trade agreements. You know, right now, we are also negotiating a trade agreement with the U.S., which is called the TTIP. 17% of the Germans, 17% of the Germans are in favor of a free trade agreement with the U.S. And as you know, on your side of the Atlantic, when Mr. Trump is attacking NAFTA, it's a triumph. So the question is in front of us. One of the questions is it still possible to negotiate a free trade agreement right now, considering the political the atmospherics in our political lives? Is it possible? And you know. Question for you, do you think that the TPP will be ratified? Really, I have some doubts. And the TTIP, do you think that the TTIP will be negotiated? You know, really, so it's really a major question. So I guess that it's one of the questions that we will have to face together, you know, really. Are we still able to negotiate free trade agreements which could be accepted by our public opinion, which means are we able to explain to them? Because, you know, disagreements, it takes 5 years to negotiate an agreement. I think with Canada it was 5 years. It's thousands of pages. You know, it's extremely complicated. So after that, to sell it to the public opinion is quite difficult. But for a lot of these people, who are rebelling, you know, really free trade, it's globalization. You know, it's really free trade is going to destroy our jobs. And they don't care about knowing what is the substance, what is the country. It's simply this sort of anti-free trade, you know, destroying our jobs, destroying our way of life. And of course, we think otherwise. So it's a question to our politicians whether we can answer to these people. The second one is, and it goes throughout the Western democracies, the Western societies, is in a sense that a revolution is starting, which is the automation. And this revolution will destroy a lot of jobs. And the question mark is whether it will create less jobs than it's going to destroy. So in a sense, the sufferings of the people who are rebelling, maybe, you know, it's not over. So the crisis is not over. The crisis is ahead of us. And I have the weakness to believe that it's better to try to solve it between countries which have the same values, but also which are facing the same challenges, so Americans and Europeans. You know, in the 30s, we chose the other way. You know, everybody for itself. And so it was protectionism, and now we know that it worsened the economic situation of each of us. So I do hope that we are not going to commit the same mistake. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Councilmember Callahan.
Yes, thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of Mayor Michael S. Rollins of the City of Dallas and also the Dallas City Council, I would like to offer a token of our esteem for you coming to Dallas, and I think the word is bienvenu, so welcome very much. And I think we ought to give him a big Texas howdy, though. Can y'all say howdy? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I was also fortunate this summer to spend time about a week in France and Monaco, and so beautiful people, beautiful country, and I was there. I flew in exactly 3 days after the police debacle that we had there, and I flew into Nice, France. So it was a very somber time going into France and seeing the somber memorials that they had placed out there on the seawall. And so my heart goes out to you and the French people. And we were both Dallas and Nice, France, were sharing a whole lot of the same kind of sadness and tragedy. So, again, enjoy your stay, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Again, I want to thank all of you for being with us, and we'll see you again soon at the next event of the World Affairs Council. Have a great afternoon.